You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Joel is beaming in today from his research trip in Invercargill, so send him your condolences for being there. In honour of Halloween, Joel wanted to talk about some spooky topics, starting off with zombie ants.
Yeah, let's talk some Halloween. I've got some really spooky science that I want to talk about. But first of all, how was your Halloween? Do anything scientific?
We did the BFM Halloween party up at Whammy Bar, I think. And I could tell you if I could remember. So this is a whole different kettle of fish that we're not going to get into today.
Sounds like a lot of scientific experimentation went down.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I was, as you mentioned, partying down here in Invercargill pretty hard, taking some science measurements of the air, which I can update you later on. But let's get into some freaky ants. I know how much you love ants.
I feel like, yeah, the last time we talked about ants, I did not enjoy that. I enjoyed the conversation, but the topic is questionable.
Right. Well, ants are pretty cool. They can jump really high. They can carry things. Like if we were an ant, we could carry around utes on our back or hop on skyscrapers or even, you know, hang out like the Cheerio effect and survive floods. So I guess we have a little bit of differing views on ants, but I will agree with you on my first point here that they are freaky. And that's when we're talking about zombie ants.
I don't like where this is going, but yeah, tell us more. That sounds like a really far out kind of science fiction concept, doesn't it?
It does sound a bit spooky. We'll say that in theme with Halloween. So it's actually not so much the ants that you want to be afraid of here, but a fungus. So a fungus actually infects these ants and then controls them. It makes them leave the safety of their nest. And then it goes and climbs up a plant stem, up about 25 centimeters, which is the zone that is the precise right temperature and humidity for the fungus to grow.
Wow.
And so it forces the ant to permanently lock its jaws, keeping it on this leaf, and then it continues to infect the ant, and it eventually will send a stalk through the ant's head. Okay, if you can imagine a tree growing out of your head.
Oh, my God.
It gets scarier. And so what happens is that it actually does this, like, right above the ant's colony. So then it can release all these spores onto all of its relatives, eventually zombifying all of them.
That, from an evolutionary perspective, it is very impressive, because, you know, kind of getting it honed down to this exact moment where you can get ants to do this wacky shit and then spread it to everyone it can. But it's also petrifying.
Absolutely, because it makes you think, well, if there's a fungus that can do this to an ant, is there anything out there that can do that to us?
I guess I wasn't really worried about us until you said that just now, but does that kind of happen to any other animals apart from ants?
We haven't been able to document as detailed as we have with this particular ant, but short answer, yes. But how this works is actually even freakier than what I even just mentioned, because with zombie ants, we think that, all right, this fungus is going to get into your brain and change the way you think. But no. We believe that it does is that as it infects you, it actually cuts off the communication of your brain to, like, your limbs. So it releases these chemicals that are actually just controlling your body for you while your brain is still intact. So you're basically trapped in your body like you're by some puppet master.
I guess the good thing about ants is that they don't have that same kind of reasoning and consciousness, that they can kind of be aware that this is happening to them while their body is being taken over by this creepy fungus.
But if they did, they would probably be pretty spooked. I don't think that's a way that you'd want to go.
So the equivalent, really, if it was a human, is that your body involuntarily is just climbing up this, maybe a building. I couldn't tell you what size that building is. It's not the human equivalent of carrying a ute on your back, but a very tall building, and then just kind of locking on, right?
That is exactly what's happening. You, if you were infected by an equivalent fungus, you would, your body would be moving, and your brain would be like, "Why? What? What's going on? Stop!" Right? But it would climb your body halfway up a building and have you just hold on for as tight as you could. Maybe to just tie yourself onto the building while your this fungus slowly takes it over and then eventually sprouts out of your brain.
Good Lord. But yeah, how prevalent is this kind of happening in the wild?
Well, I mean, it is not super prevalent, but it just shows the length that even these things like fungi can evolve along with these other species.
Wow. So we'll leave you with that. Nah, there is more content. Our second Halloween topic is the possibility of literally being scared of death. And I feel like we're kind of on the way here, at least for me personally.
So if this does not freak you out entirely to death, then that's a good sign because, well, it turns out that it actually is physically possible to be scared to death.
Right.
Woo! It's a good thing to look forward to on the old Halloween. So what happens when you do have a bit of a fright? The amygdala is responsible for registering that. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how walking in the forest or listening to bird call can actually help your amygdala from showing fear or stress.
Mm.
So in this case, we're talking about the old amygdala, and this is now when they are experiencing fear and stress. It triggers this response in the nervous system. And from there, the hypothalamus will release stress hormones, cortisol, and adrenaline. So physically, what's happening once these are released is this causes your heart rate to rise, your lungs to dilate, allowing more oxygen into your system. So basically, you're putting all your eggs in the baskets of the things that might keep you alive in some sort of stressful situation, and organs that prove unnecessary, like the gastrointestinal system, might shrink, pushing contents, you know, up or even out.
I see. The old fight or flight.
Yes.
Mm.
Exactly what occurs. And so when there's an excess of adrenaline, this can actually trigger a surge of calcium, which rushes into the chest cavity and can stiffen your heart muscles, ensuring that they stay taut until a threat has passed. If there's too much calcium or if you're particularly oversensitive to its presence, this mineral can actually stop the heart from beating normally.
And it's kind of like, so this calcium is flooded in and it's not a very, is it like a quick fix or is it, I don't know, does the body kind of reset when you calm down fairly quickly or is it a very long, slow, arduous process?
So if you do calm down, then yes. Yes, it is a rather quick process. Similarly, if you've ever heard the term broken heart syndrome, you can actually die from a broken heart. This is the same type of response where there is just an abundance of stress releases these chemicals and, of course, can affect how your heart functions. But usually, if you have an extremely stressful situation, not just a one-off fright, you usually go back to normal within about a week or so. So it's not permanent, but if you are overly sensitive, for instance, it could certainly impact your mortality.
Wow. So, I don't know, if it's just a one-off fright and you're not particularly sensitive, you'll be fine. If you are sensitive and it's kind of a very long, ongoing, stressful, arduous thing. So this calcium is responsible for your kind of heart not functioning anymore. Is there kind of any like relation to long-term stresses perhaps, or is that kind of a different field?
With long-term stress, you will release similar type of chemicals like cortisol, for instance, and they can, of course, impact as well. So stress is something that your body uses to its advantage in a life or death situation, but a continuous amount of it is not something that's good for you.
Wow. So yeah, I don't know if you've particularly had some stressful times or some scary times this Halloween, watch out for that. That sounds quite awful.
Yeah, it's always good to take a nice relaxation and a break away from stress if possible, because things will go back to normal, but it does take some time depending on the situation.
So what would you recommend to kind of get your amygdala back to its normal resting state?
Well, what I would recommend based on our previous information is go take that walk in the woods, go for a wee hike, maybe do some camping, get out there in nature, listen to the bird sounds, just to absorb all the greenery you can.
And if you've had a particularly wild Halloween and you couldn't quite make it out to the wilderness, maybe just listen to some nice bird song from the safety of your own bed while the room stops spinning around you.
Yes, and shout out to the Rock Wren, by the way, Bird of the Year.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful little bird. It's very cute. I realized that it was apparently the weight of a mallow puff, which is adorable.
What?
It's...
Man, birds are so cool. One last bit of fun here is spooky, if you don't mind me interjecting. I know you talked with this about Alan a couple weeks ago with the Nobel Prize, but quantum mechanics, nothing is spookier than quantum entanglement. And I won't get into too much detail because I know Alan did cover this very well, but basically what Einstein didn't like at all, he called it literally spooky action at a distance, is where two quantum particles can talk to each other via teleportation faster than the speed of light, which, of course, nobody likes to hear that, and that, well, reality doesn't exist on the local level. A particle isn't we don't know what it is until we measure it. And that actually is true. It's not that we can't see what it is. It is not in a defined state until we measure it. So those are the things about quantum entanglement that were spooky. But I'd like to take this one step further about exactly what this means. So we do have these quantum entanglement, and we believe that might help with things like quantum computing. So one big question people are starting to have is, once we get the computer resources necessary, does it mean that we could simulate our own existence?
Nothing scarier than getting very existential.
Yes.
So what have they found so far?
Well, it's all very theoretical right now, but let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you think that the human species, now or in the future, will ever develop the technology with the potential to, say, simulate consciousness or simulate the universe?
I think so. I think it is very much in our capacity, as someone who knows very little about science and kind of gets my only knowledge from this program.
So if that's the case, if you think the humans or any other alien race that might be out there is capable of the technology to simulate the universe, and that they have an interest in doing so, then the logic goes that we are almost certainly living in a computer simulation. If it can be done, it already has.
Wow. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yes. Now, we of course don't have any way of proving this or what it would actually mean, but there are a lot of philosophers out there that suggest that if you think that it's a possibility of happening in sometime in the future of life in this universe, then it is an almost near certainty that we are involved currently.
I don't know what to say.
It's the ultimate conspiracy theory.
I feel like, yeah, there have been a lot of conspiracy theories floating around recently, in recent weeks, and this is kind of, this one almost takes the cake.
Pretty spooky, huh?
Well, happy Halloween, right? This is kind of very much on brand for, well, the first day of November, but I don't know, there's just been a lot to think about, as usual, for Dear Science.
I agree. It's something that I like to think about, but I mean, at the end of the day, we'll probably never know. I mean, some researchers estimate that there's, you know, a 50% chance that we're in a simulation, which I think is incredibly high.
Yeah.
And if we are able to start to produce artificial intelligence that can have some sort of consciousness, then the odds of us being in a computer simulation increase dramatically as well. So that would be a very interesting time point in our scientific discovery.
We'll leave you with that then. Dr. Joel Rendelaw beaming in from Invercargill. Always a pleasure. Maybe you enjoyed that, maybe you hated it.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.